This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. I am not going into my major client tomorrow, as far as I know. But who knows? All is well. All is well. It was a good week at work. Got a lot of good things done. Just keep plowing forward. Lots and lots of things to do. But we're just plowing forward, just step at a time, step at a time, step at a time. I should get the rest of the edits in on book 8 tonight onto the consolidated copy. This works much better. I used to try to put it directly into the Word file, but then the pages would skew and nothing would line up. So now I've got a good portion of my beta readers sending them to me on a PDF of the beta interior. So I can just read the stuff straight in with that. So that works really well. And then anyone who sends me anything else, I just enter that into the PDF as well. So all the page numbers stay the same. Then once I got that all, I have that all done. Then the next step is to march through that PDF one time and put the edits into the Word document. So I am hoping to be starting that tomorrow. I have sent out an email to the beta readers and said, "Okay, this is your last chance to get some corrections in." So we'll see. From those I have heard from who have actually read Book 8, they seem to like it, which, you know, that's fine. I mean, I like it, which is really kind of the important part, because I'm writing to explore my world, not necessarily for readers, but we'll get to that again in a minute. So that's all going fine. We do have Dad in at assisted living now. We are still in this, he's got in his head what full nursing care is like, that someone's coming in and checking on you all the time. And I keep telling him, that is not what it's like, Pop. You know, they're coming in when there's a problem, but they're coming to get you for meals, but that's it. You know, but he's convinced. He told me tonight, "Yeah, but you have an idea, but you might not be the right idea." And I told him, "Look, Pop, I was there a whole lot more with Mom than you were." "Well, yeah, that's true." So we go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth on this thing. He thinks that I've got to have full-time care, and then he'll say, no, this is fine. And, you know, I mean, but it's all just flesh. It's just flesh. So as soon as he gets by himself, then the flesh just starts working on him. No one knows you're going to have a problem. You're going to fall down and no one's going to know. And I got tickled. I got tickled at him tonight. "Is that my friend Tim Strathy? Is that my friend Tim Strathy? I think it is my friend Tim Strathy. Baby." Yeah. Anyways, I got tickled at him tonight because he was like, "Well, I just want to go see Jesus." I said, "Well, Pop, when you fell down, you weren't very interested in going and seeing Jesus." "Oh, that was terrible." I said, "Well, if you wanted to go see Jesus, why didn't you just lay there and say, 'Jesus, take me home?'" But yeah, so there's a disconnect between what we claim we want and how we get there. But anyways, it's an adventure. This is an adventure. Before Pop moved in, I told him, "Pop, you're not going to be able to make your own food anymore. And you'd go, 'Oh, I'll just eat whatever they give me.'" Okay. Okay. Well, it's been a week and a half now. It's going, "Oh, I don't like that. Oh, I don't like that." Okay, Pop. Well, but that's flesh. It's all completely predictable. It's flesh. So, you know, my job here is to try to keep his flesh from getting him to from doing something silly, like moving him into a dinky little room over at the lodge and then him just being miserable. But on the other hand, it doesn't really matter where I have him or what's going on. If he continues to let his flesh run, and frankly, he's 95, and so his executive function is impaired at this point. So I'm sure it's much harder for him to even, you know, get his flesh under control. So it really doesn't matter where he is, he's going to be miserable. This is the sad part. He's going to be miserable because it's flesh. It's the little tyrant, and it's just going to make him miserable no matter what. It's sad. It's just sad. I think I mentioned I've already told my daughter that if I ever get to that point, she just needs to look at me and say, "Well, life's hard, then you die, Dad." And that's going to be our code word for stop it. Get control of it. Anyway, so all is well. All is well.
Oh, man.
Then every time I get ready to leave, he says, "So what are you going to do now?" And tonight I said, "Pop, what do you think I'm going to do now?" "Well, you're going to go home. You're going to exercise. You're going to write." "Right." So there you go. You already know, Pop. But, you know, he doesn't want me to go. But, hey, he's in a place where people are watching over him. So it's okay. Anyway, I came across it's not a new YouTube video, but I popped up in my feed, in their predictive feeds, and I started to listen to it. I thought that's pretty interesting, and it illustrates to me perfectly something that happens to me frequently. When people like Sunday, we were out to eat, my wife and I, after church, and some old friends that we knew came by, and we were chatting, and so he said, "So what are you inventing these days?" And I said, "Well, I'm not inventing anything, but I am writing." And so I started talking about the 24-book series, Windfall, and, you know, their eyes just keep getting bigger and bigger. 24 books, yeah, they're all about 450 pages a piece. What? And I do two a year. What? And then the inevitable question. "How many are you selling? Where are you selling them?" Yeah, I don't worry about selling books. What? And this article, or this YouTube video, reminded me of this because I think it perfectly illustrates the corruption of the arts when they become commercialized. So the name of this TED Talk, it was by a guy named Thoughty 2. Because apparently there was a Thoughty 1. And the name of the YouTube video is "The Truth Why Modern Music is Awful." And he started out talking about the Beatles, how that in December of 1966, they went into the Abbey Road studio and they recorded an album. They spent 333 hours, and to put it in this guy's word, many questionable substances. And they produced their eighth album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club. Said it would go on to sell over 32 million copies worldwide, and it was named the greatest album of all time by Rolling Stones and many other publications. He said, you know, when you listen to the Beatles albums, he said, when you listen to, like, Bob Dylan and compare that to Britney Spears, or Led Zeppelin, compare it to Lady Gaga, or the Kinks and compare it to Katy Perry, he said, there's obviously a difference. He said, basically, you know, we older people listen to the stuff now and we think, this all sounds the same. What is going on? He said, what's interesting is there is some scientific research behind the fact that we're not just imagining that this stuff all sounds the same. It really does all sound the same. So he said in 2012, the Spanish National Research Council did a project where they took like 500,000 recordings from 1955 to 2010, and they ran them all through these complex set of algorithms, and they measured three distinct metrics: harmonic complexity, timbral diversity, and loudness. And they found that the timbral diversity in songs had drastically dropped, that the quality of sounds within the music that were... Wait, I have lost my place. In other words, the song's richness and depth of sound peaked around 1960, and it steadily declined ever since. So he noted something like A Day in the Life by the Beatles, and I went and listened to it, and, you know, it's pretty interesting. I mean, from a sound perspective, it's really interesting, because they had like 14 orchestral musicians with them, you know, flutes, tubas, bassoons, harp, clarinet, strings. He said you compare that to something like Robin Thicke's Blurred Lines, where basically it's a drum machine and a bass line. And he said, granted, that's an extreme example. He said, but the number of instruments on your typical pop song, there just isn't that many instruments. They're all kind of just boom, chicka, 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 boom, chicka, boom, chicka, boom, you know. He said, the other thing that you find is that there was a blogger, and he, Patrick Metzger, he said he found that a lot of the artists were using exactly the same sequence of notes. It was the fifth to the third to the fifth. Whoa, whoa. And he said, you hear that over and over and over in current pop music. And he dubbed it the millennial whoop. And he started talking about why this would be. And the fact is that our brain likes familiarity. The more we hear the same sound over and over, the more we enjoy it. So if we get used to hearing the millennial whoop, and they put the millennial whoop in songs, that makes the song feel familiar. So there's a better chance we're going to like it. And that like it is important. We'll get back to that in a minute. The other thing that he talked about was the fact that the lyric, they analyzed the lyric intelligence over the past 10 years, and they used, I think it's called the Fletcher-Kincaid Readability Index, which indicates how difficult lyrics are to understand, what grade level you need to be, and it's dropped a full grade level over the last 10 years. The other thing that they noted is that the loudness of the sound itself, has changed. There's not as much dynamic range, because what they're doing is they're using a lot of compression. So they're trying to get your attention by boosting the sound as loud as they can, but in order to do that, they have to compress the loudness and take out the highs and the lows. And it, again, turns into just mush. He played an example of like a drum track and something else that wasn't compressed, and that and stuff that was compressed, and maybe it's just because I'm a sound guy. You can really tell the difference from a timbral standpoint. Everything on the compressed track is just real kind of tinny and brittle, and that's the sound you hear mostly on the tracks that are produced. The other thing he said that I didn't know, he started naming off all these. He said, what do these stars have in common? You know, Britney Spears, Taylor Swift, Robin Thicke, Jesse J, Justin Bieber, Katy Perry, Maroon 5, Avril Lavigne, Christina Aguilera, Kesha, the Backstreet Boys, will.i.am, blah, 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 blah. He said all of them have used one of two hit makers, songwriters in Hollywood. He said there's two guys. I'm trying to remember what the statistics were, but this is amazing. Mr. Max Martin is one of them. He said, this man is single-handedly responsible for over 24 number one singles and thousands of songs in the top 100 over the past decade. I Kissed a Girl, Baby One More Time, Since You've Been Gone, California Girls, Shake It Off. This guy wrote all of these. He said, and there's another guy named Dr. Luke. And he said, between the two of them, they actually have penned the vast majority of pop music these days. He said, so there's a reason everything sounds the same.
Oh, man.
And the other thing he talked about is the hook. The hook in the songs now typically is moved farther forward, so you get to the hook sooner, and then they just beat the hook into your brain. And the other thing that's interesting is that the price of launching a new group has just skyrocketed. So it used to be a couple of $1,000s, you could get a new group started. He said now it's anywhere from $500,000 to $3 million. And he said what they do is they groom some person and they put out, you know, a hit by this person, what is going to be a hit. And then they just pay all kinds of money to make sure that you hear it over and over and over and over. And there is a technique, he named it in here. One moment, let me get around the corner. I just checked my mail and get around the corner. Okay, there we go. He named it, he called it near... Just a second. Mere exposure effect. That with a mere exposure effect, you may not like something the first time you hear it, but when you hear it again, your brain goes, oh, I recognize that. And there's a little dopamine pop when your brain does that. You hear it again, oh, I recognize that. Dopamine pop. And pretty soon, you start getting those little dopamine pops, and it's like Pavlov's dogs. And then, finally, you get to the place that whenever you hear that, you like that song because you've heard it so many times. Now, granted, that can be overdone. I think we've all had songs where that can get overdone, but it works for a while until people get tired of it. And all of this stuff, the compression, the dumbing down of lyrics, the dumbing down of harmonic and timbral content, all of this stuff, the basic reduction of every pop song to something to do with reproductive function. You know, all of that comes down to the fact that art has to sell. It has to sell. That the only justification for art is to sell. And if it doesn't sell, then it's not a success. And whenever I talk to people about writing, inevitably the question comes up. So how many copies do you sell, or where do you sell it, or where? And they all look at me like I'm crazy when I say I don't write books to sell. I write books for the pleasure and the enjoyment of writing books. Just today, I had somebody was talking to me and said, you know, I was talking to so-and-so and we were thinking if you recorded your books for audiobooks, then people could listen to them when they're driving down the road and then you'd sell more. And I looked at him and I grinned and I said, you know, I've checked into that and Audible will let you as an author record your own stuff and upload it to Audible. They'll let you do that. I said, here's the problem. My phone is ringing, but it says restricted, and that usually means it's one of those. There's no problem with your credit card, so we are just going to say no. We don't need to hear that. So, but just today. So you can make it. I said, okay, well, here's the deal. I said, Audible allows you to do that. But for me to record it, edit it all up, and get it onto Audible, it's going to be at least 30 hours, if not 40 hours. Basically, a week's worth of work per book. Now, I said, I could spend a week doing that, or I could just spend a week writing on my next book. And he kind of nodded. And I said, even if I wait till I retire before I do that, when I finish the Windfall series, there's going to be 24 books. That's 24 weeks. That's almost half a year. Half a year I could spend putting stuff on audio, crossing my fingers, hoping that would make something sell, or I could just go write. And frankly, I'd rather just go write. Because the justification is not how many books I'm going to sell. It is the experience of writing that I love. I just had breakfast with another friend who does some writing, who's a writer as well, this week. And He finds my windfall project personally offensive. As soon as he heard what I was doing, he just looked at me. He said, "I think you're writing too fast." Mind you, he has never read one of the books. He's never read one of the books, so he has no idea. He just, "No, it's just too fast. You can't write that fast. You need to slow down." And he brought it up. "Well, I've told you the way I feel about that. You just need to slow down." And I said, "Buddy, I can't slow down. I've got 24 books to do. And if I slow down, I'm not going to get them done." "Well, then you just shouldn't do the project." It's like, what difference does this make to you? You know, because, you know, he was talking about the fact that, you know, you're writing for readers. And I'm like, no, I'm really not. I'm not writing for readers. I don't care if the books sell or not. I'm writing for the experience of writing. I'm writing to figure out the world. And I gotta tell you, you know, working on Windfall, the Counting House, book 8, closing up the arc. As I'm writing it, I'm like, "Hey, look at that. That worked out. Hey, look at that. That worked out." I mean, I'm getting dopamine response all over the place. Such a joy. It's such a joy to write. I don't need to justify it any other way. Because the other thing is, it's a connection to the divine. I know I didn't plan half of the things. I didn't plan a quarter of the things that came together in Windfall, the Counting House. They just showed up. I was going through stuff and it was like, "Oh, I could do that." You get this little whisper, "Oh, I could do that." I'm just throwing stuff against the wall. And all of a sudden, I get to book 8, and I'm writing book 8, and I'm like, "Well, that worked out pretty good. That was fun." Because it's the joy of creating art. And that, I think that's really the deep purpose of art. Art puts you in a space where there was nothing, and then there is something. It puts you in that creative, divine space where you're going along and you realize you do not know where you're going, and suddenly there's a flash of insight and you realize where you're supposed to be. And you have enough of those insights and enough of those flashes that it's really hard to imagine that you're in it alone. And several years ago, I realized that this really is an interesting way that God woos us. That we get involved in these creative projects, and then he helps us here, and he helps us there. And it doesn't matter whether you name the name of Jesus or know who he is. He just keeps doing that. Such that truly creative people have a hard time imagining that there's nothing beyond themselves, because it just feels like there is. I read a creative book once, a book on creativity, and the lady who wrote the book was just spending so much time trying to convince people that, no, that's just your subconscious. There's really nothing. We know it feels different. We know it feels like there's a voice that's speaking to you, but it's really just your subconscious. Like, okay. You just keep telling that and try to convince yourself of that. But I guarantee you, to the people who are in the creative endeavors, that as they are in that and there was nothing, and then the word is spoken, and there is something that just feels like Jesus. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.